TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Who will protect the Earth? Western Shoshone Land Rights. Every year, the Western Shoshone and their supporters gather at the entrance to the Nevada test site. They pray for peace and protest, with direct action and blockades, the destruction of their land by nuclear testing and waste storage. The three-day encampment has its own micropower radio station, and the audience for the talk you are about to hear included Bechtel Corporation employees and the private army protecting the Nevada test site, the Wackenhuts. For 10 years, Christopher Sewell has worked for the Western Shoshone Defense Project. It is housed in a trailer in Crescent Valley, northern Nevada. Staff and white supporters have come and gone from that lonely outpost in a tiny mining town. He has stayed the longest. In all these years, he has learned much about traditional rights, legal battles to protect them, about gold mining, and nuclear issues. He gave this talk to the supporters of the Shoshone at the campsite of the 2003 gathering in clear view of the entrance to the Nevada test site. Here is Chris Sewell speaking in a tent on a windy afternoon.
And seeing as how I'm a history buff, I'll give everyone a brief history lesson as I've been come to understand it from listening to people and doing research. So we had this treaty, a treaty of peace and friendship between two nations, Western Shoshone Nation and my nation, which I reluctantly admit, the United States. The treaty was essentially an agreement to share. That treaty was signed at gunpoint, but nonetheless, it's important because it was an official recognition by the U.S. government that there was indeed a Western Shoshone Nation. And in that treaty, they also recognized the boundaries of that Western Shoshone Nation. And the Shoshone Nation, the Western Shoshone Nation, extended all the way from, and continues to extend from, the Snake River in southern Idaho, all the way down south of here through Death Valley and portions of the Mojave Desert. The treaty was a treaty to share. Shoshone people said, okay, with the gun at their head, you can build a railroad through our land. You can put a telegraph through our land. You can bring a stagecoach through our land, and we're not going to stop you. You can even mine on our land and set up ranches to feed those miners, and you can cut timber to provide for those ranches and those miners. Well, since that time, unfortunately, the U.S. has come to believe that they no longer need to share anymore. And so you have a situation where the original people who, in a solemn and legally binding international document in that treaty, agreed to share their land, are faced with the United States that is telling people, you no longer have any land. It's not yours anymore. We have no legal requirement to share it with you. And they justify that basically through the proceedings of the Indian Claims Commission. And the Claims Commission was set up in the late 1940s, around 1946, ostensibly to provide some measure of justice to Indian people that had their lands illegally taken away from them at some point in the past. Unfortunately, if you look back at what the Indian Claims Commission actually did, it becomes apparent that it was more interested in clearing title to land than it was in doing any justice. In other words, they wanted to make it clear that these lands were no longer Indian lands, and they did that by paying the Indians for those lands at a value at some point in the past. The lawyers who wrote the Indian Claims Commission Act came out of Utah. And those same very firm that wrote the act immediately fanned out into Indian country across the West to start soliciting claims. Because under the Indian Claims Commission Act, the only thing the Claims Commission can do is pay you for land that you've lost. And it even sets it up so that the lawyers representing the tribe would get 10% of the total value of whatever was compensated to the Indian people. And to make matters even worse, the lawyers didn't have to be working with any particular representative government or body from the Indians that were making the claim. So in other words, they could go out to Indian country and get a couple Indians together and have them make a claim on behalf of their whole nation, which is exactly what they did. You didn't have to have the tribal government making the claim. You didn't have to have the traditional government making the claim. Apparently, it didn't really matter who made the claim. The important thing was that the claim was made. And so they immediately started this process in Shoshone country in the late 40s, early 1950s. And the way it's been described to me by various people is that many Shoshone people at the start of the process thought that the lawyers were arguing for their treaty rights because they understood that there was still a legally binding treaty in place there. And the lawyers, for their part, certainly didn't try to dissuade people from believing that because they needed at least some sort of people to say that they were making the claim for. So they started the process, and it went on for decades. Part of the reason it went on so long was that they couldn't find anything that happened that would legally have transferred title of the land from the Western Shoshone Nation over to the United States. There was no official war. There was no official surrender. Unlike a lot of treaties with Indian people, which were treaties of cession, where Indian people were agreeing to give up a portion of their land to retain a part, this treaty was a peace and friendship, and it granted certain rights to white people, but it didn't give up anything for Shoshone people. So they couldn't come up with a date. So how could you pay the Indians if you couldn't figure out when you actually took the land? And everybody assumed, all the white people assumed, that, well, obviously they'd lost the land. So they came up with a date. The lawyers representing the Western Shoshone and the lawyers representing the U.S. basically entered into a gentleman's agreement, so to speak, and said, well, we can't really figure out what exactly happened that got us the land, but we know it's ours, so we're going to come up with a date. And they came up with July 1st, 1872. And that's going to be the date we're going to say that you lost the land on. And therefore, we'll pay you for the land as it was valued in 1872. And again, nothing happened on, you know, what happened on July 1st, 1872? It was probably a hot day in the desert. And that was probably about it, because there wasn't much else going on. In 1872, the majority of Western Shoshone country was still unoccupied by white people. In 1872, the Shoshone people had lost title to all of their land, and we're talking, the figure that they used was 26, over 24 million acres, and actually, the actual territory is actually far greater than that. It's probably 40 to 60 million acres, but the number they were compensated for was around 24 million acres, and they said, you lost it all because of gradual encroachment by white settlers and others. And, of course, we've never quite figured out who the others were, but it was white settlers and others. Now, remember, under the treaty granted white people the right to come and set up their ranches. It granted them the right to create these mining towns. But now the government, 100 years later, is saying those actions made you lose title to the land, even though those were accepted actions under the treaty. So people started to realize what was going on, and there were various attempts by Western Shoshone tribal governments, traditional leadership and organizations to intervene in that claims process. And every time Shoshone people in of one form or another, one entity or another, came to that commission and said, this is all wrong, this is not the way it happened, the commission refused their rights to intervene. Well, finally, it came all the way up to the 70s, and at which point in time you actually had a federally recognized tribal government that was the client of the lawyers advancing the claim. Well, come the 70s, the Timok Tribal Council, in their wisdom, said, no, this is ridiculous. This is not what we want. We're firing the lawyer. And they fired the lawyer and hired a new one to argue for their continuing rights under the treaty, rights to their Aboriginal homelands. Well, the U.S. government said, you can't do that. We don't recognize your new attorney, and we are going to finish the process with your old attorney. And this all comes back to the fact that under U.S. law, Indian people are wards of the state. We want to be able to take care of ourselves, and we need the land to do that. But, you know, apparently that's too much to ask for, you know, and that's a pretty sad state of affairs. So anyways, the Dans went all the way to the Supreme Court, and they said, the BLM's got no right to come and tell us that we're trespassing, you know, because of everything I just told you. And the Supreme Court said, you've been paid for your land. And because you've been paid for the land, this other law says you can't talk about it anymore, so you're out of luck. And now the BLM throws that in our face and say, you've been paid for your land, and you all went to the Supreme Court. So we went to the international community. So in 1992, working with a nonprofit Indian law firm out of Montana, the Indian Law Resource Center, the Dan family, the Dan sisters, made a formal complaint before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Now, this Inter-American Commission, it was set up by the Organization of American States. Now, again, remember, the U.S. helped set up the Organization of American States. So essentially a U.N.-like organization for North, Central, and South America. And the U.S. was a big supporter of the Inter-American Commission when it was first set up. The Inter-American Commission, for the last 10 years, investigated the case brought forth by the Dans. During that 10-year period, the U.S. was filing its own submissions and saying, this is not a human rights issue. This is taken care of. They've had their day in court. Inter-American Commission, butt out. It's taken care of. Well, the Inter-American Commission deserves a lot of credit for standing up because they made an initial report last fall, and the report was made permanent in January. And what they found is that they said that the U.S. has clearly violated the human rights of the Dan sisters and other Western Shoshone people. And in particular, they have violated their right to property, they have violated their rights to due process, and they have violated their rights to equality before the law. And this is very significant because the Inter-American Commission looked at the Indian Claims Commission process. Because the U.S. is claiming that that was a legal process, that was a court, and therefore they got their day in court because they went through the Claims Commission process. Well, the Inter-American Commission looked at the Claims Commission process and saw it for what it was, which was basically a kangaroo court designed to pay off the Indians and clear title. This was January. The report was made final. In February, they came in on the armed raid to take the horses again. And the U.S.'s position has been they don't care what the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights says, that the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights has no jurisdiction over the U.S., and the U.S. has no legal obligation to listen to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. So it's discouraging, to say the least, but it's becoming more blatant. What I was thinking when we were dealing with all the feds in rounding up the animals the other month was that, you know, what we are seeing there in Crescent Valley on a very local level is merely a local reflection of a U.S. policy that is being conducted on an international level. And that is that the U.S. does not find itself subject to anybody's opinion or regulation, will clearly ignore international law when it's against the interests of the administration, and will, you know, baldly invoke international law when it does advance the interests of the current regime. So, you know, where do we go from here? Again, I want to encourage you to contact your congresspeople about the Western Shoshone Claims Distribution Act. It is very important that we defeat this now. And not that people don't deserve some sort of monetary compensation for the damage and crimes that have been done, but it can't be in exchange for the people's future generations' rights to use and occupy their lands and practice their culture like has been done for thousands of years. Who's promoting these bills? Well, there's a group, a self-appointed group of Western Shoshone called the Western Shoshone Claims Steering Committee. They're promoting the distribution. But Senator Reid, Senator Harry Reid, Mr. Environmental Harry Reid, has been at the forefront of pushing this bill forward and has taken a lot of political heat because of it. So what does Mr. Reid have to gain from getting Shoshone people their money? Who's Reid doing this for? You know, what does he have to gain from it? And how do you do that? Well, you follow the money, okay? Follow the money. Who's the big money out here? Well, let's look at the corporations. The first one I can think of is Bechtel. Okay? Bechtel. Bechtel runs the Nevada test site. Bechtel built the Hoover Dam. Bechtel built some of the largest gold mines in the northern part of the state. Bechtel's going to run the anti-terrorism center. Bechtel might build Yucca Mountain. Donates to Senator Reid's campaign. Okay, let's follow some more money. Well, what are the two biggest industries in the state? Number one's gambling. What's number two? Mining, exactly. So, look at the campaign donations. Senator Reid has been the number one Democratic defender of the mining industry in the country. He gets big bucks from campaign donations. Representative Gibbons from Nevada here, Republican. Again, big supporter of mining. Big supporter of national security and the test site. What we're seeing is a conspiracy of interests, that there are a lot of very powerful entities that have a lot to gain by continuing to exploit and use Western Shoshone land. And unfortunately, in the current state of our political system, our political system represents their interests far more than it represents the interests of anybody else. Now, another thing, geothermal energy companies, big deal. So Senator Reid, the environmentalist, well, we need clean power like geothermal. Well, there's hot springs all across Shoshone country, and a lot of them happen to have a lot of cultural significance. So now, they want to develop these hot springs, the last remaining free-flowing hot springs in Crescent Valley on Dan family traditional land are currently up for lease by the BLM. You have a lot of people that want to privatize, that can't stand the fact that most of Nevada is so-called federal land, a lot of the local non-Indian population. They would like to see everything privatized. Well, you can't privatize or sell any of this land until you clear the title. Well, until Shoshone people are paid off, there's still a cloud over the title. Hence, the need to get that bill through and pay people off so they can say they were paid and they cashed the check. We've gotten Amnesty involved. Amnesty International has finally seen the light and are starting to get more involved in indigenous issues, and have in fact started to look at the Western Shoshone issue and get involved. I have some Amnesty flyers that has information about the case on it. So that's encouraging. Sometimes it seems like the truth will make you miserable or make you a prisoner. I mean, that's honestly the way, the more you know, the grimmer it gets. But knowledge is power, and the more we become informed and the more we use that information to act from our hearts, the stronger we are. So anyways, thank you.
That was Christopher Sewell. He was recorded at the 2003 Western Shoshone Peace Gathering outside the entrance to the Nevada test site. Now I'm taking you back to another campsite, where Chief Raymond Yowell of the Western Shoshone National Council spoke a few weeks earlier. The 2003 spring gathering of the Western Shoshone was held on the slope of Mount Dinabo, above Crescent Valley in northern Nevada. An important topic of that gathering had been the recent livestock confiscations of the horses and cattle owned by the Dan sisters. The traditional Shoshone refused to pay grazing fees and assert their treaty rights, since they are running their cattle on Shoshone land. The Dan sisters have received some media attention, but they are not the only ones resisting. As I am recording this introduction at the beginning of June 2003, the Shoshone of South Fork have just been served orders to remove by federal agents. Chief Raymond Yowell is one of them. Here's his report about the 2002 federal raid on his cattle.
My livestock and those of Myron Taibu from the South Fork Reservation were taken on May the 24th. To back up again, in 1980, the Western Shoshone rejected the Indian Claims Commission award, and they rejected it with a question. They asked a hearing officer, by what United States law did the United States acquire Western Shoshone territory? When the hearing officer couldn't answer the question, every Shoshone that testified from there on asked the same question, and when he couldn't answer it, they rejected the claim. I asked the same question, and when he couldn't answer it, I rejected the claim. Shortly thereafter, Duckwater Reservation, Yamba Reservation, and the Southfork Reservation, along with the Dans, quit paying the BLM. And we did that from Southfork with a letter to the BLM stating what we had asked at the hearing of record. Until you show us, by your law, how you legitimately acquired West Shoshone territory, we're not going to pay you. And so for 19 years, up to last year, for 19 years, the BLM held back. And finally, last year, they had the guts enough to go ahead and take the cows of myself and those of Myron Tybo. Not only did they violate what we would call Indian treaty law, but they violated their own law in that no due process was given myself or Myron. And when I say due process, they did not go to their court and obtain a court order to seize our private property. The sheriff was in on it. The district attorney was in on it. They claimed that the district attorney said that their papers were in order. I'd like to see those papers, how they justified the taking of livestock without a court order. And, of course, our cattle were, I think, a week later sold at an electronic auction for about maybe a third or maybe one-fourth of what they're really worth. Myron and I are still looking at how to, get our value back out of our property. And we're having problems with finding a lawyer. Lawyers want a lot of money. We don't have money. So we're looking for a lawyer who would do it on a contingency or even pro bono. But we haven't found one yet that's willing to do that. Following that confiscation in September 23rd, they came here on the other side of the mountain up here and confiscated Marion Carey's livestock. It was like a military action, I guess you could say. About 40 people running around with guns, cordoning off various areas. And we weren't allowed to go in very close to observe what was happening. We did eventually get through the road that they had blockaded. When the Eureka County Sheriff came and said they couldn't blockade the road. But when we arrived at the roundup, we couldn't get off the road or we'd be arrested. So those are two events that happened within the last year that, in my opinion, are serious breaches of law. Those are the big events that happened. The National Council continues, we have our monthly meetings. It's always in Austin unless there's a special, the council makes a special meeting time somewhere else. And the usual events are always talked about. We're opposed to Yucca Mountain, the high level of nuclear waste that's proposed to be stored there. We're opposed to that for a couple of reasons. The first is that we haven't given the United States our territory to put that stuff there. That's our stand on that. The second one is that it's a health danger. The atomic testing that has gone on down there, did horrific damage to Mother Earth. Our spiritual belief is that, as Corbin has said, that Mother Earth is where everything comes from. This is what all life comes from. And to go in and blow, 800 atom bombs in her, I don't know, that's pretty sick. To me, I'm just an average kind of a rancher kind of a guy, but they, since 1946 or 1945, they found out these things would blow up. So what more do they need to know? They know how to blow it up, and that should be it. But no, they continue to test and test and test, and in that way have contaminated that ground down there. That would be unusable for thousands and thousands of years to come. I think that's main points that we have. The Shoshone Nation, like I said, it meets monthly. One of the big things we're doing that now is to fight against the payment of the claim, because that is one of the big levers that we have against the United States. They have not showed us to this day how they legally acquired our territory. If the payment of this claim, then the United States will say to the international scene, we paid them for their land, and it'll be a way out for them, you know, as far as international people are concerned. And that's our big lever, because right now they can't. And what they had hung their hat on, even in the Dan case when that came out of the Supreme Court, that when the Supreme Court ruled that we lost our land because the Secretary of Interior accepted the claim on our behalf, that is now found to be illegal and incomplete. So the biggest thing they have against us now is not even there, even in their law. And we intend to work on that. And I would encourage everybody who's here to fight from that, you know, to oppose that from that point. The thing that we're saying to every congressman and everybody who will listen is that there is now no statutory basis for the distribution of DACA 326K, because the statute that was there is incomplete. That's one line that we're using, you know. And whoever wants to do that, as individual Shoshones or others who are supporters, we encourage them to use that wording, that there is no statutory basis now to distribute the claim.
That was Chief Raymond Yal of the Western Shoshone National Council. The Shoshone fear that the forced distribution of money will lead to turning over of Shoshone land to the expanding gold mining and geothermal industries. This is not just a Shoshone issue. I hope you feel moved to make your voice heard. For more information and addresses of people to contact, please go to the website of the Western Shoshone Defense Project at wsdp.org and check out the action alerts. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on the Western Shoshone on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this program on the Western Shoshone by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. Thanks to Govinda Dalton for the recordings. My name is Maria Gillardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.